Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome. Tonight is, of course, a bittersweet class. This is our final class of the series, believe it or not. I was just thinking as, preparing for that and the fact that this is our final class of the series. This is our fourth year, Monday nights running, that we have spent Monday nights between October and May together. It's over 100 classes that we have been here together. Which is really something. That is right. That deserves more than a piece of cake. That deserves a round of applause. Although I do appreciate there is some cake in the back. It looks like it's dairy. And in celebration, I appreciate the good sentiment for all those who have been responsible for that back there. I appreciate that. I would also just like to take this opportunity to give a tremendous thank you to Gail Vexler, because none of this would happen without her. It is really, from the very beginning of Tanakh, where we had our fancy notebooks and the photocopies and the holes. Gail is here the whole time Monday. She does not go home. She just stays here because I always give her the material like at 5:01. And she is taking care of everything. So not only does a thank you go to Frank, but really to Gail as well. So really, Yashikayach Gail, 4 years. It's really pretty amazing. If anyone has suggestions for what we should learn next year, let me know, because I'm totally out of topic. I can't even think of anything else. We've covered it all, so you'll keep me posted. Okay, tonight's class, the miracle and mystery of Jewish survival. It really is a fantastic concept. We'll talk a little bit about this idea that we are still here today. So it's a miracle which we sort of take for granted because we're all in it. We're living this miracle. Not only are we living this miracle, but we see all the problems. We can't get things right. We still fight. And there's so many issues in the Jewish community. You talk about the school system. You've been around for 3,000 years and we can't seem to work out a system that seems to work and that's affordable. And we got shuls opening and closing and fight. We see all those issues. At the end of the day, the fact that we're here to fight about Jewish education and shuls and all the stuff that goes on and politics is truly miraculous, as we will see. Well, I'd like to share a couple of insights from those on the outside looking at us. We're on the inside. We only see it through our little our eyeglasses. And one of the things, as I've mentioned many times, that I personally love about studying history, Jewish history, world history, is really scaling back and seeing that perspective of what it's like to be a Jew, to have lived as a Jew all these years. And we'll see a number of different quotes to give us some of that perspective, and then learn a couple of sources that really give us some understanding as to why this is, how this is, and what we're supposed to do with it. What I'd like to start with is a quote from Mark Twain. I've for sure quoted this before over the years. That happened last week. I'm not sure if it's a battery issue or I'll just... you cannot silence me. That's not going to work. Let me try a new battery. Meanwhile, Gail even puts spare batteries up here. That is amazing. Okay. Ha! Gail Vexler, ladies and gentlemen. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. I didn't even script that. That just happened. Was it? The maintenance people are there. And she's humble, too. Giving credit to us. Okay, anyway, so I have the opportunity many times. There are various school groups that come through Beth Jacob, but non-Jewish groups, schools, sometimes 6th, 7th, 8th graders, sometimes they're in high school. I've even had postgraduate students who come to either study the architecture of the school, but mostly they're here to study religion. It's a basics religion class, particularly when it's in the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. And these schools, some of the more progressive schools, actually spend a week at the end of the year after studying various world religions, going to the different places of worship. And we ended up somehow on their radar screen as the Jewish stop, and they would come here to learn about Judaism a little bit. It feels like I'm in a zoo, and they come and they watch and they ask questions and they point. But so it is, and we have an opportunity to teach these children about Judaism. I always love to do this, particularly because I know there's a very high percentage of Jews who are usually in these classes, and it's an opportunity I have these Jews in an Orthodox shul to teach them a little bit about Judaism. When I have this opportunity, I almost always start with the following passage of Mark Twain, which, again, I'm sure I quoted this over the last 4 years. There's no way that I haven't. But I'm going to read it again because this is literally the piece to start with in the topic that we have tonight. Mark Twain writes in 1899, it's probably the beginning of your packets, Mark Twain was not a lover of the Jews. This piece that we're reading right now is the final paragraph of a second article that he wrote. The first long article he wrote was bashing the Jews, blaming them for all the problems in Europe. And then someone wrote a letter to the editor saying, why you got to be so nasty to the Jews? What did they ever do? So then he wrote a second article explaining why the Jews are so bad and why they are at fault for everything. And he concluded the second letter with this little paragraph, which is the end of a very lengthy piece. But the paragraph concludes, if the statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 1% of the human race. Agree or disagree? No, we're much less than that. He was way too generous with us. We seem like we're like 50 to 60% if you read the news, but it's really not true. We're far less than even 1% of the human race. It suggests a nebulous, dim puff of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of. But he is heard of, has always been heard of. He is as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. Now, I always like to mention when I read this to the students, that last line of our commercial importance being extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of our bulk. Now, Mark Twain lived in 1899. The Nobel Peace Prize, or all the Nobel Prizes, did not begin until 1903. So he's writing this not even knowing that there's going to be such a concept of awards given to world people who contribute to science, to history, to art, to music, to medicine, to literature, to all of these areas. Since 1903, there have been about 100, 110, 180, they've given different things. So one would imagine if we're 0.2% of the population, which we are, out of 1,000 awards, we should have earned, just based on statistics, if we're 0.2% of the population, out of 1,000, yeah, we should have gotten about 2. We'll round it up, 0.2%. 800 awards were actually given since 1903. So out of the 800, we should have taken home 2. The Muslims, for example, who are 1.4 billion people, have taken home since 1903, 11. Excuse me, the Chinese have taken 11. They're 1.4 billion. And the Muslims are 1.3, 1.4 billion also, 6. Now, we are numbers-wise. How many Jews are we?
14 million.
So we're talking big numbers here, like 1.4 billion, 14 million. I've said this before also. But when you do a census of China, 1.4 billion people. So there's always a percentage of error that you assume in any census. I think it's 1.8%. So what's the percentage of error in the Chinese 1.4 billion? It's 25 million. Right. There are more Chinese missing in the world that we can't find. They might be here, they might not be here, we have no idea. 25 million that we just sort of like throw away, like, I don't know, give or take 25 million. When you do a census, that's more, 10 million more than there are Jews in the world. So when Mark Twain writes that we are extravagantly out of proportion to the bulk of our numbers, that's what he means. How many Nobel Prizes have Jews taken home out of the 800? It's 180. 180, almost one-fourth of Nobel Prizes awarded to the advancement of world everything has come from us, a population that is tiny. 25 million is 14 million Jews is nothing. And I don't need to tell you whether or not this century has been good or bad to the Jews. This century has been horrific. World War I killed 250,000 and displaced a million Jews. World War II, we don't even need to talk about, was the destruction of everything Jewish. And in this century, we earned one-fourth of all of Nobel Prizes given. In this century, to world advancement. Says Mark Twain, just extravagantly out of proportion to the bulk, the smallness of his bulk, his contributions to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, and abstruse learning are also way out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers. He has made a marvelous fight in this world in all the ages and has done it with his hands tied behind him, meaning no one has said to us, the Jews, here, let's give you everything that you need to succeed. Instead, what they've done is they've tied both of our hands behind our back and said, try to survive while we try to kill you. And with all that, through the centuries, we've made this marvelous fight and contributed to the world's lists of great names. He could be vain of himself and be excused for it. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, the Persian rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed, made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out, and they sit in twilight now or have vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakness of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal, but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? Magnificent piece. You can't be more poetic to describe from an outsider's perspective of what it's like to be a Jew. What is the secret of his immortality? So I sit here in front of these classes and I ask them. But before I ask them to answer his question, I say, I just want you guys to know there's a day school down the street. And in that day school where my kids attend and other children attend from kindergarten to eighth grade, every single child in that school from K all the way up knows the answer to Mark Twain's question. So I figure I'd ask you guys. You guys seem like pretty intelligent children. What's the answer to Mark Twain's question? What's the secret to Jewish immortality? So they come up with some very interesting solutions. Now none of them say that. You know the answer, but they don't answer. So the kids say, unity. The Jews get along. No, that's not the secret to our immortality, for sure not. Some of them say education. Jews value education, and because we value education, so we're always learning. I say it's very good, but it's certainly not a secret to immortality, and it's certainly not it. I'm going to leave this question hanging. Most of you probably already know the answer to this as well, and we will get to that. But Mark Twain is a beautiful introduction to tonight's topic of the secret to Jewish immortality, the mystery of Jewish survival. How is it possible that we are still here? So let's be like, well, why shouldn't we be here? Let's start with the premise of like, listen, what's the big deal? Maybe it's not such a big deal that we're still here. So it actually is a big deal that we're still here. So let's talk about it literally from, if you want to talk to an anthropologist, to a sociologist, a historian, why is it a big deal that we should stop and think and say, maybe there's something to this. We need to actually take note of this. Well, the reason for this is as follows. If you'd stop and think and say, well, what should it take for a people to survive? If you look back in history, we're 3,000 years old from the time of the giving of the Torah until now. Is that so unusual for a people to survive for 3,000 years and still be an identifiable people? Well, if you were to create such a people, there'd be a couple factors that you'd want to put into place to make sure that they actually survive. Because if you didn't have these factors, you'd say that can't possibly work. One of the first factors that you would probably say would be, let's start with numbers. If I wanted a group to survive, and I was going to take them through 3,000 years of history, so playing the statistics, I'd like them to be pretty big. Because the larger they are, the more likely it is that they can manage their way through history and all the things that take them away, and disease and pogroms and all sorts of other things like that. So I'd like them to be pretty large. Well, where do we stack up in terms of numbers? We don't. We're pretty small. We're pretty small. According to Josephus, at the time of the Second Temple's destruction, we were actually the exact same size as the Chinese. I forget the exact numbers that he put us at, but he put us both around the same numbers. And they're at 1.4 billion, and we somehow are still at 14. We've been at 14, 12, 18, 12, 18, in that area forever. We would like to move the decimal point, but we don't. If you take a look, we're going to be moving back and forth in your sources. I just want to pull out a couple of things from your sheets to look at some primary sources as we go. If you flip to page 9, you will find a small passage from Devarim. This is the discussion that Moshe tells the Jewish people about what will be in exile. I'm in source number 1 on the bottom of page 9. Moshe here is speaking, "I call heaven and earth as witness for you today that you will then quickly perish from the land that you are crossing the Jordan to occupy. This is if you will not follow the laws of the Torah. You will not remain there very long, since you will be utterly destroyed. God will then scatter you among the nations, and only a small number will remain among the nations to which God will lead you." You say, well, that's an interesting thing. Now, Moshe is speaking on the way into the land of Israel. Nothing has happened yet, but he's forewarning. If you go into this land and don't do what you're supposed to do, you will be scattered. And let me tell you, when you're scattered, it will be just a few of you. And I'm going to scatter you all around. Now, you're reading that as a historian. You would say, okay, well, let's figure out a way for these people to survive. What's the two greatest ways to make sure these people survive? I know. Let's make them very, very small in number and then scatter them to the four corners of the earth. That's a great idea. That will make sure that they survive. No. So here's God telling you, I'm going to exile you. And this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to make you small in number and scatter you everywhere. And then somehow, from that, you're going to survive the exile? Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. So we don't have numbers. We don't have, then, the other three classic things that a historian or an anthropologist would say you need as a nation. Three things you need. Land, language, common history. You need land, language, and history. Those are the three things that you need to be a nation. You need to talk about here in schools, so we learn Georgia state history there in our day schools, because it bonds us together as Georgians. And in America, we learn American history. Why do we all learn American history? Why don't we learn the history of India? Well, because it's not relevant to us. We share a common bond. We learn American history. And that's what you share to make yourself into a nation. You have to know your nation's past. So, well, do these scattered few Jews in the four corners of the earth, few in numbers, do they share a land, a language, or a history? Well, we don't share any of those things. We don't share land because when we were exiled 2,500 years ago, when we were exiled for almost all of those 25, we were 2,500 years, then we went back to the land of Israel, then we were exiled again. Or 7 years exile, 500 years back. So the last 2,000 years, have we shared a common land? Not at all, nothing close to it. Not only that, the one land that we would say we all share, the land of Israel, for 2,000 of these years, was off limits to almost every single Jew in the world. It wasn't part of our world. So you had Jews living in Yemen, and Jews in Morocco, and Jews in Egypt, and Jews in France, and in Germany, and in England. Certainly no common land that would bond them together. Do we have a common language? Certainly no common language. Our Jews, in wherever lands they grew up or they lived in, they spoke the language of the land. Sometimes they created a new language from within that land, like Ladino or Yiddish. But the Jews who spoke Ladino certainly didn't speak Yiddish and didn't speak English. And so we have a people scattered who don't share even a language. At best, you could say Hebrew, but Hebrew's been a dead language. One of the miracles of the Jewish return to the land of Israel is the rebirth of the Hebrew language. It's the only language in the history of the world, the only language in the history of the world to be dead and come back to life as the spoken language of a country. It's never happened before. But that wasn't the language that necessarily bonded us together. A little bit it does through the Siddur and through the Chumash, but it certainly wasn't a spoken language. Do we have a common history? So we feel a kindred spirit to Jews in other places, but we don't share that history. The Jews of France or Spain or of North Africa, they didn't share the same experiences. So we don't really have any of the things that should keep us together. We have a biblical history, that's correct. So we have, from a certain perspective, until a certain point of time, we do. And that's important because we all share that history. And then there's a break. But if you were looking at this from a sociology perspective, and you would say, from the exile 2,000 years ago, 2,000 years is a long time, would it make sense that we would expect these people to remain together? So there are a lot of factors that you would say, short, small in number, scattered all over the corners of the world. They don't share that language. They don't have a common land to go back to. They all yearn to go back, which is one of the things that we have that constant yearning to return to a common land, but it's certainly not the most obvious choice for a people to continue to exist. But that would only be half the problem, the fact that we don't share some of those things. The real challenge that we've had is that the world hasn't been passive to us as we have made our way through history. We have experienced a phenomenon called anti-Semitism, which has done a really fascinating thing. I'd like to share a couple of sources with you. Take a look at page number 10. If you look at page number 10, this sums it up really beautifully. Source number one at the bottom of the page, Michael Curtis wrote a book, Anti-Semitism in the Contemporary World. He writes as follows: "The uniqueness of anti-Semitism lies in the fact that no other people in the world have ever been charged simultaneously with alienation from society and with cosmopolitanism, with being capitalistic exploiters and revolutionary communist advocators. What we share is, and we've spoken about this throughout various courses throughout our 4 years, is that no matter what, you can blame it on the Jew for doing something. Capitalism, it's a Jew's fault. Communism, it's also the Jews' fault. And guess what? They're both right. It's true, right? Both sides were led by Jews. And no matter what's gone on in world history, as Michael Curtis points out, anti-Semitism has reared its head and said, it's the Jews' fault on all sides. And never, he writes, has any other people been simultaneously charged with every different thing. The Jews were accused of having an imperious mentality, and at the same time, they're the people of the book. They're accused of being militant aggressors, and at the same time, of being cowardly pacifists. With being a chosen people, and also having an inferior human nature, with both arrogance and timidity, with both extreme individualism and community adherence, with being guilty of the crucifixion of Jesus, and at the same time, held to account for the invention of Christianity. Everything and its opposite becomes a reason for anti-Semitism." And that has certainly been true and continues to be true, summarized by some of the things that we've discussed all year. And I don't want to keep bringing it up. There's a certain mentality that was, the Jews are always blaming the non-Jews for all of their problems. And I want to talk a little bit more about this as we go along, but there's a certain reality. As Mark Twain wrote, he has done so, the Jew, with his hands tied behind his back. It's not just that we're small a nation, that we've been scattered, that we've had to deal with all of these things, but throughout our history, we have had our hands tied behind our back. We have had nation after nation attempt to prevent us from doing the things that we'd like to do. I'd like to share with you one other quote from Leo Tolstoy, if you flipped it back to page 4. Source number 3. Says Leo Tolstoy, "Who is the Jew? What kind of unique creature is this whom all the rulers of all the nations of the world have disgraced and crushed and expelled and destroyed, persecuted, burned, and drowned, and who, despite their anger and their fury, continues to live and to flourish? What is this Jew whom they have never succeeded in enticing with all the enticements in the world, whose oppressors and persecutors only suggested that he deny and disown his religion and cast aside the faithfulness of his ancestors? The Jew is the symbol of eternity. He is the one who for so long had guarded the prophetic message and transmitted it to all mankind. A people such as this can never disappear. The Jew is eternal. He is the embodiment of eternity." It's always interesting to read what's written about us. When those who look at the historical perspective, who see the rulers of the world who want nothing than other, as he writes, to disgrace and crush and expel and destroy, and yet we continue on, not just that we survive, but that we thrive. And in every nation that we come into, we enhance and contribute to, despite the fact that we have suffered from all of these various things. You know, there's it's oft quoted, I think you actually have it in your sheets, from Blaise Pascal, who was asked, it's told, I'm just reading the page 3, that King Louis XIV of France once asked him, the renowned mathematician, philosopher, to give him proof of the supernatural. And Pascal answered, "Why the Jews, Your Majesty, the Jews? You couldn't possibly need more proof of the supernatural other than the Jew. So that's the reality. So others besides ourselves see us as an eternal people, see this miraculous, mysterious, how is it possible that you're still here? We've discussed many times, one last point before we move on, Christianity itself has long struggled with this, because the entire nature of Christianity is we believe everything up to the Old Testament, and then there's a New Testament. And then Christianity superseded the Jewish people. So you might have been a chosen people, but not anymore. Which means what should happen to you is you should evaporate, dissipate, and just disappear from the world. And the presence of the Jew has always been a major theological thorn in the side of Christian thinkers. How is it possible that they survived? Why are they still here? How is it possible they've returned to the land of Israel? And you'll find various new interpretations of, oh, well, we need this to happen in order for that, or you have the Pope's people, we were the witness people in order to witness the second coming. That's why the Jews have to survive. It needs to be explained how and why the Jew is still here. Okay, so that brings us back to the answer to Mark Twain's question. So we have this big mystery, we have this mysterious concept, the fact that we've miraculously somehow survived, maintained ourselves, continued to thrive. When you look at it from, if we would be given this class 60 years ago, coming right out of the Holocaust, it would be a different class. But now we're talking after 65 years, after the birth of Israel, the return of the Jews to the land, we're watching the miracle unfold. Half of the world Jewish population is now back in the land of Israel. Unheard of since the time of the second destruction 2,000 years ago. The language is back. Torah learning is centered in the land of Israel. There's more Torah learning in Israel now than ever, even during the times of the Second Temple period. It's just the numbers of Jews. It's miraculous. It's unbelievable what's taking place. What's the secret to our eternity? So you all know the answer to that question. I'll read it just inside. Just let's give some classic source, and I'll have to tell you a little cute little story. The answer, if you flip to page 6, so the answer to this question is the eternal covenant. That's the end of the day. It's the Torah. The Torah that we have, the adherence to the laws of the Torah, is as simple as it comes. If you look in source number 1 from Shmos, book of Exodus, and now if you will heed my voice and you will keep my covenant, you will be a treasure nation to me from among all the nations, for all the land is mine. And the next source, you have taken God today to be a God for you and to go in his ways and to keep his statutes and his commandments and his laws. And God has taken you today to be a treasure nation. And from the verse in Yirmiyahu, I have loved you with an everlasting love, therefore I have drawn out kindness to you. And in verse 4, I am with you to save you. I will bring annihilation upon all the other nations upon whom I scattered you, but I will not bring annihilation upon you. Various different sources in which Hashem says, you are my people, I am to you. I'm not going to spend much. This is something that we are all familiar with. I want to share with you, just to you know, we can read it in the sources and you can really see it in practice. One of the teachers of these groups that comes to Beth Jacob is a woman by the name of Emily Harrington, I think is her name. She's a teacher from the Mount Pisgah Christian Academy, and she brought her students. And after the class, she emailed me to thank me and said that the conversation that I had with the students stimulated a lot of their questions. Can she continue a dialogue asking me her students' questions, and we can discuss Judaism's perspective on various things? Absolutely. We've had a number of dialogue back and forth about a number of different issues as her students have asked various questions. One of the questions that they asked, which is relevant to our discussion tonight, is her students asked if we are descendants of the Pharisees. So we had a whole class on that, if you remember. Did I mispronounce that? Yeah, we had the Sadducees and the Pharisees. So in the Gemara calls a group of Jews known as the Prushim, which is translated as the Pharisees. The Prushim were the Torah true Jews who maintained the tradition of the Mesorah of Judaism and fought a battle against the Sadducees, the Tzdukim, who believed, if you remember, only in the written law and disregarded the traditions of the oral law. So from a Jewish eyeglass perspective on history, it was the Pharisees, the Prushim, who are the champions, the reason why we exist today, to talk about what a miraculous concept that we're still here, is because we still have the Torah in the form that it was given, which was fought for by the Prushim against the Sadducees and others who tried to do away with the oral law. So she asked me, that her students asked, if we are descendants, like in the flesh, like the people that her students met, are you the real descendants of the Pharisees? So I said to her, and I had some recollection in the New Testament that the Pharisees are not the heroes of the New Testament. But I don't remember any details, I just remember that. So I said, I'm not really sure, I'm not familiar with the New Testament. I'm not really familiar with what you think of when you say that word, but we have a tradition of a group of Jews who we are all descendant of. Every Jew who's alive today is a descendant of the Prushim, as the Gemara refers to them. They are often translated as the Pharisees. So if we're referring to the same type of people, the answer to that would be yes. So she writes back, she says, yeah, I think that's the same. And she writes as follows. The New Testament shows that the Pharisees were leaders who were strongly invested in the law. So that makes sense, that's who the Pharisees were, Jews who were strongly invested in the law. She says, perhaps the only difference would be, between your perspective and ours, is Jesus' strong criticism of the New Testament Pharisees valuing, quote, the letter of the law above, quote, the basis of the law, understood to be love. So she writes to me that, that's our tradition. You're the Pharisees. You're the people that Jesus criticized for being caught up on the letter of the law and not what really should be done, which is the basis of the law, which is love.
And,
yeah, they've always loved us, 100%. You know, love between man and man and man and God. And that struck me as like such a fascinating thing. I got this email from her just last week. Such a fascinating thing. That's exactly right. What has maintained us until today that there are Jews here today? One reason and one reason only. It's the law. That's it. Throughout our history, take 2,000 years, as soon as any group of Jews moves away from the letter of the law, look back 200 years into the future, where are they? We don't know. They just disappear. Any Jews alive today, any Jew can trace themselves back 100 years, 200 years to an observant Jew. And the only question is, like, how long does a line last? Because without the letter of the law, it only lasts so long. It's a reality. So just, I'm not, no editorial comments, just statement of fact. You can't trace a Jew back 400 years and not find an observant Jew. It doesn't exist. And she writes, yeah, that's exactly, that's Christianity was a argument against the letter of the law, only focused on the basis of the law. As long as you have the love, that's all that you need. And that's never worked for the Jewish people, because there's an eternal covenant. And the eternal covenant is, if you keep my law and hearken to my word and observe my commandments, you will be an eternal people to me. And as soon as you do not hearken to that law, you will not, you can't be. It is the law that has maintained us. I take my students in front of me, these 6th grade, 7th grade, 8th grade, non-Jewish students, and I say to them, do you know what the answer to Mark Twain's question is? Mark Twain, the brilliant author, couldn't figure this out. Do you know what the answer is? I'm sure I've done this routine for you before, but I'm going to repeat it again because it's so great. I say to them, do you see what's behind me? And they see there's the cover of the Ark. I say, the secret to Jewish survival, the secret of Jewish eternity, is what's behind that ark. Do you know what's behind that ark? I say to them, I say, behind that ark is the Torah, is the scroll of the 5 books of Moses. And do you know when we write that scroll letter by letter, letter by letter, from a scroll that came before it and a scroll that came before it. And do you know that there's one letter missing in that scroll? One letter missing. If even one letter is cracked, that the ink does not make it complete. Do you know what we do with that scroll? We put it aside and we bury it. Because the sanctity of the words, the transmission directly from Mount Sinai for 3,328 years to today in Atlanta, Georgia, is such that transmission has to be pure and complete. And do you know something I tell the students? I am not even going to open up the ark to show you that Torah. Because the sanctity of the Torah is such, it's not a museum piece. We don't just open up the ark and take out the Torah for anyone to just look at and see. And when that ark does open up during the service, do you know what happens in this room? It's everybody stands. And when the Torah is moved from one place to another, everybody follows behind. And they give it a kiss. And do you know what would happen if, heaven forbid, that scroll would fall on the floor? Say, everyone in the room would fast. And he would fast for a whole day. And you can't even touch it with your hands. You use a talus just to hold on to it. And I am building up this concept. And as I'm speaking, and you can see, you know, those who are listening, as I'm talking, this Maisa Shehaya, this happened. I'm not making this up. I'm in the main shul. I'm giving them a little speech. Norm Schlosser Gabai strolls in. It's a Friday morning. I'm talking to the students. Strolls in, gives me a little wave as he walks. He walks right up to the ark. I am not making this up. He opens it up, takes out a Torah. Now, they don't know who he is. He's just some guy who walked in. Takes out the Torah, walks down to the Shulchan, puts it down, opens it up, you know, rolls it to the right place, puts it back, and walks out. And if I could describe to you the looks of the faces of these kids, like, you know, they're like looking for the lightning strikes. I'm like, what happened? Because I had expressed to them that what's behind that curtain is the mysterious secret to Jewish eternity. And that we treat it as such. That we recognize every letter, you can't touch it with your hands, if it falls, it fasts. But we don't think of it that way. We are so used to it. It's like just part of, you know, part of our life. That, you know, a gabbai would just, you know, come on in, take it out, open it up, find the right place, put it back. You know, if we were there in the room when that happened, and I've seen this happen, you know what our response would have been? Like, oh, I have to stand. Oh, I can't believe I'm in here when he's doing this. It's like, oh. That's, you know, because, like, what an inconvenience. But, you know, you talk to kids and you give them their first exposure to, like, eternity. The mysterious eternity of the Jewish people. They mean something. They were scared. And, you know, there's something that we need to remind them. The reason why this class is part of our curriculum is because you all knew the answer to the question. I am not, you know, creating something new. Oh, the Torah is the source of Jewish eternity. Yes, you know the Torah is the source of Jewish eternity. Hold fast to it because that is the secret to Jewish survival. But we need to appreciate every once in a while how crazy it is that it worked. Like, the historians look at us and they scratch their head and say, we have tried everything to get rid of these people. And it doesn't work. They're still here. They're few in number. 14 million is nothing. 14 million Jews in the world? Nothing. How many Jews live in the state of New Jersey? Forget Jews. How many Americans live in the state of New Jersey, right? More than 14 million. Nothing. And we survive. We're in the news every day. We're pushing the envelope in technology, in agriculture, in everything. The world cares. And it doesn't make sense. And you ask, why? How? And Mark Twain couldn't figure it out. Neither can anybody else. Except from the inside. Like, what do you mean? What do you mean the secret of our eternity? You hold on to that Torah. You hold on tight. You keep its laws. And when you do so, you become a piece of eternity. And what the amazing part about it is that each one of us is part of that, even though in our own little world, none of us feel like we're part of eternity. We're just living out our, you know, lives, trying to make a living and do the right thing as best we can. And we're all part of a cog that's an eternal cog. It's an amazing thing to see. It's an amazing thing to be a part of. What's amazing about, not just that we're eternal, but that we're eternal throughout the exile. We are eternal throughout the exile. If you look to page 9, you will see source number 3. Despite all this, this is from this past Shabbos. We read this in this past week's Parsha. Despite all this, while they will be in the land of their enemies, I will not have been revolted by them, nor will I have rejected them to obliterate them, to annul my covenant with them, for I am the Lord, the God, their God. Even in the exile, even when they're dispersed, even when they are scattered, and when they are obviously not doing the things that they need to be doing, I will never abandon them. They will go through the horrors of, you go through the Crusades, the Inquisition, Tachvatat, the Khmelnytsky Revolution of 1648 and 1649, the Holocaust. It doesn't matter. We always are here. We are always here. I will share with you one other beautiful thought from the Maharal. There are three blessings that the Jews are given back in the Chumash. Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov are given three blessings, comparing us to three different things. They are the stars, the sand. Anyone know that those are the two easy ones? The dust, excellent, the dust of the earth. Three things. Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, between the three of them, we'll be as numerous as the stars of the heaven, we'll be as numerous as the sand on the earth, and we'll be as the dust of the earth. And the moral asks, what's the difference between these three? Why three different things? Stars, sand, dust. What's the meaning of each one? And he expresses what each one expresses to the Jewish people. Stars, every star is a world unto itself. Even a single star has value because it's a world. So when you say that the Jews will be as numerous as the stars, it's a blessing that not only will you have numbers, but that each one will be magnificent, will be a world unto itself. Every soul, every Jew will be treated as such. Think about that in relation to sand. What's the difference between the stars and the sand? Sand is the exact opposite. A single grain of sand is worth nothing. Single grain of sand? You would never say, like, about the stars, you name every star. You would never name a grain of sand. You wouldn't even name 1,000 grains of sand. Even 1,000 you might not be able to barely fit in the palm of your hand. What's the value of sand? Only in its number. When you get... What's that? Well, that's what we'll get. That's dust. We're not there yet. Sand, the actual grains of sand, are only valuable in their numbers. You can do something with a lot of sand. A little bit of sand is meaningless, but a lot of sand, you could build a sandcastle, you could have a sandbag, you could do things with it. It's a different type of blessing. And the blessing of dust, says Moral, dust is something that always comes back. You can dust as much as you want, and if you turn your back, just turn your back for 30 seconds. You know what's going to be there when you look. So you laugh, but it's a blessing. And Yaakov, our forefather, was promised, I will bless you like the dust of the earth. You will never disappear. You can wipe away, and somehow, it's part of the world, and it will be back. And you can dust and you can dust and you can dust, but you can't ever get rid of it. It comes back. And it's used as a blessing. And Hashem says to the Jewish people and to our forefather Yaakov, you'll go through some difficult times. The branch will be cut and trimmed and pruned to a point in which you'll say, we can never grow back from this. And to that we're given a blessing, not to be as numerous as the stars and not to be as numerous as the sand. To that we're given a blessing, you'll be like the dust of the earth. As long as there is a shred of a root left, a shred of the root of the Jewish people, from that you will regrow. We are in a generation who are witnessing this in a way, maybe it was possible you would have seen this, maybe in the generation following the Crusades, and maybe Inquisition was too long a period of time. I don't think there's ever been a generation like us who, living today, can point to a person and say, that person went through the Holocaust and lost everything. Mother, father, sisters, cousins, grandparents, everything. And I see him now, and he has 37 great-grandchildren. I don't know that there's been another generation in the history of the Jewish people who today we can say, I saw it. I saw a person who had nothing, was a single individual from an entire family, and all of it was destroyed. And look at them now, at the wedding of a great-grandchild, surrounded by 30, 40 great-grandchildren. And we know there are people who can say they have 50, 60 great-grandchildren. That generation is passing on. But we have seen with our eyes the blessing. We say, like, that's impossible. They came out of the war. The world was a mess. There was no state of Israel. There was nothing to come to in America. They had nothing. 60 years? It's a flash.
60, 70 years? How did that happen?
We take for granted. You look at the land of Israel now, you look at the Hasidic world, in shambles after the war. And they're like this explosion of people, of Jews. After the war, how many Jews lived in the world? What do they estimate? 12 million. You think about how many Jews have been... When you think about the numbers of Jews that assimilation has taken hold of, and then now we're at 14, 15, 16 million, an explosion of Jewish life. It's unbelievable. It's literally unbelievable. And we're watching it. We're not just reading a history book. We are watching the blessing of, you'll be like the dust of the earth. It will just grow back. And not over 300 years. It is miraculous to stop and to think about that which has taken place. Which leads me to one last point, and I want to show you a video. What then is the purpose of anti-Semitism? The context of what we're speaking about. What is the purpose? So instead of just saying, they are, you know, the nations of the world hate us. There's more than that. What? Why? What is the purpose? What is the meaning of that? So it's not for nothing. It is not for nothing. I wanted to share with you, if we flip to page 11, two sources, both from the Gemara. One in Maseches Sanhedrin, source number one on bottom of page 11. The Gemara says, in the name of Rabbi Yeshua, if they do not repent, they will not be redeemed. Jews are sent into exile. You have the opportunity for repentance. If you don't repent, I can't redeem you. Rather, what do I do? What do I do, says God, if my children won't repent? God brings upon them a king whose decrees are as harsh as those of Haman, and the people of Israel repent, and they return to the right path. This is a Gemara. This is from our sages. It's a very clear connection. We have a job to do. We are still in exile. We are now we're at the end of the road. The lights are right at the end of the tunnel. It's not just a little light at the end of the tunnel. It's already half of world Jewry is back in the land of Israel. And now it's just, we're waiting for the rest of us to go. And throughout Jewish history, we've been waiting for this moment. And there's one thing that we needed to do to get there, and that was fix all of the issues that we got in the Jewish world. It's time for repentance. It's time to return to the law. Says the Gemara, Hashem says to the Jewish people, I'm waiting for you. If you won't do it, I'll help you along. I'll help you along. And you will come under the decree of a king as evil as Haman, and that will help you. And it is an unfortunate reality that we have seen over and over and over again in ourselves. You just watch the cycle as it takes place, as we're watching what goes on in Israel and around the world. Every time something terrible happens to the Jewish people, what happens? It's every time we come together and we are better people. Every time. It could be a random three teenagers in Israel. It could be eight yeshiva students in some yeshiva in Israel. Like, no connection to us. Yeah, we're all Jews. And when tragedy hits there, we become better here. And the question that people always ask, why does this have to happen? I don't know why, it does. Because we can't do it on our own. We don't do it on our own. One of the great quotes, Fred Glusman showed me a quote. Just yesterday, Yom Yerushalayim was yesterday, celebrating the reunification of Yerushalayim. It's been 2,000 years since Jews have had full control of Yerushalayim. 2,000 years since a flag of the Jewish people, control of Eretz Yisrael. So Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, you should live and be well in Israel. So he wrote a book, the 28th of Iyar, writing a book about the date of the Jewish calendar that the Jews received the word. He was in Israel at the time that year, and he wrote a book. Many of you, I'm sure, either have it or have read it. So there was a passage in there that Fred showed me right after davening yesterday. And he says it's his favorite. He likes to read it every year. And Rabbi Emanuel writes about the euphoria that just swept the country, really worldwide Jewry, when Yerushalayim is Har HaBayit Biyadeinu, the Temple Mount is back in our hands, and it was just such a crazy time. And he said, it was like dancing in the streets, hugging strangers. It was unbelievable. And it says in the day or two after the war ended, there was a discussion in Shul as to how it should be celebrated. And some people said, we need to say Hallel. And others said, we can't say Hallel. And he said, and a fight erupted in the Shul. And Rabbi Emanuel writes, "Ah, discord had returned, the war was over." And that's the story of our people. Like wartime, there ain't any group of people I'd rather be at war with than Jewish people. I mean, Jews go to war and we literally become a family. Like, I don't think another people in the world. My nephew was in the army during this last summer. And all he could say to us was, "Die in my pizza. Please stop sending pizzas. We can't eat another slice of pizza." Because what do we do here in America? We want to be part of it. We want to send him a pizza. Like, "Die, Kvar, please. No more pizza." But, you know, that's what we do. That's what we do. And we do it in so many ways. But as soon as the war is over, oh, man, get out of my way. That's so Rav Emanuel wrote it in 1967, right after the reunification of Yerushalayim. Like, Jews are fighting, the war must be over. So the entire purpose of anti-Semitism, the entire purpose of all the tzaras that we have, all the difficulties, all the problems with the nations of the world, it's not because they hate us. It's because, if you remember back to our first year, Tanakh B'Shana, we found this in Tanakh over and over and over again. They are a rod in the hands of the Creator of the world. When you are struck by a rod, you do not get angry at the rod, but at the hand controlling the rod. Jewish history is filled with problems, filled with complaints, filled with pogroms and inquisitions. And it is a mistake to get angry at the rod, because it's never, Jewish history's eyeglasses, never, ever about the rod. The rod is always the problem, but not the source of the problem. Always. And it's easy to get lost and get angry at the rod, because the rod is rotten. But it's not the rod. It's always the hand behind the rod. And the hand behind the rod has one objective and one objective only. Lezakos es Yisrael, to purify, to correct, to put us where we need to be, to end this exile and bring us back. It is miraculous, without question, that we are still here. I know that most of you probably don't. I gave you the entire packet, because this entire packet is just filled with magnificent quotes, sources, non-Jewish sources, just looking at our people. How amazing it is that we are here. And we're at the end. We literally are at the doorsteps. We are almost there. And it's unbelievable. It's an amazing miracle. It really is. And I can guarantee one thing based on the words of the sages. This last piece is not going to be pretty. That's the sages have said clearly. These final steps are going to be filled with pain as we get there. And there's a reason for that. We're still correcting. We're working our way towards the perfected nation that we need to be, the light unto the nations. But there's the only way to get there is to hold fast. Hold fast to the law, hold fast to our Torah. That is literally the secret of Jewish eternity, the answer to Mark Twain's question, and the fact that we are still here. I would like to show you, it's about a 20-minute film, so it's 9 o'clock now. It's a beautiful clip about this topic, the mystery and of the Jewish survival. For those of you who want to leave at 9:15 or even now, you are welcome to. But I thought fit beautifully what it is that we are talking about. And I wanted to show that to you.
There was a time when everyone in the world was pagan, and virtually every society practiced human sacrifice, routinely killed unproductive, sick, and unwanted children, saw women and children as property at best, saw life as a meaningless endeavor. In such a world, would you believe? Remarkably, this world of darkness. One man who chose to live apart, two journeys in a different religion, one step and followed one God, who by his divine deliverance, one man.
millennium of Abraham, that have canvassed all the nations of the earth, what would they have said of Abraham's journey? In most of Africa and Europe, they would have laughed at Abraham's madness and pointed to the heavens, the life of earth, but from all eternity, and he might escape his fate. The Egyptians would have shaken their heads in disbelief. The early Greeks might have told Abraham the story of Prometheus. Do not overreach in the times. Come to resignation. In India, you would be told that time is black, irrational, and merciless. On every continent, in every society, Abraham would have given the same advice. Wise men of Persia, Heraclitus, Lao Tzu, what they give their followers. Do not journey, but sit. Compose yourself by the river of life. Meditate on its ceaseless and meaningless flow.
Abraham was one man who charted a radically different course. And from this one man evolved a people unlike any other. A people who crossed paths with virtually every great civilization in history. A people whose history is unlike any other. A people whose impact on humanity is unprecedented. A people who are known to the world as simply the Jews. Over 3,300 years ago, an event took place that happened only once in human history. And that was an entire nation experienced and witnessed divine revelation at Mount Sinai. The giving of the Torah, the Ten Commandments, the five books of Moses, by God to the Jewish people, and through them to the world. What happened at Mount Sinai changed the world forever. For the first time in history, man had been given a divine moral compass, a guide for how to best live one's life, to perfect oneself and the world. In the ancient world, in the eastern part of the Fertile Crescent, also known as the cradle of civilization, is the Holy Land, the land of Israel. And there, for centuries, the Jewish people flourished and lived in peace. And then, because they did not live up to their divine covenant, the Jews faced destruction after destruction at the hands of their enemies. First came the Babylonians, then the Persians, then the Greeks, and finally, with all their fury, the Romans, who forced them into exile and dispersion. For over 2,500 years, Jews suffered persecution. They were tortured and massacred, their synagogues burned, their women violated, their books vandalized and set ablaze, century after century after century. Throughout their history, and even until modern times, for reasons of jealousy, of people blaming the ills on a convenient scapegoat, and because Jews stood up and continued to stand up for the absolute moral standard that comes from the belief in one God and the holiness of human purpose. The Jews have faced and continue to face the demonic and destructive forces of anti-Semitism. Quote, David Lloyd George, British Prime Minister.
Of all the extreme fanaticism which plays havoc in man's nature, there is not one as irrational as anti-Semitism.
There is no greater example of this than the evil of one man who projected his own failings and those of his followers on the Jews, and that was Adolf Hitler.
Providence has ordained that I should be the greatest liberator of humanity. I am freeing man from a false vision called conscience and morality. The Ten Commandments have lost their validity. Conscience is a Jewish invention. It is a blemish. The heaviest blow which struck humanity was Christianity. Bolshevism is Christianity's illegitimate child. Both are the inventions of the Jew. The struggle for world domination is between me and the Jews. All else is meaningless.
For over 2,500 years, since the first exile in 586 BCE, Jews were scattered across the globe like stubble in the wind.
God will then scatter you among the nations from one end of the earth to the other.
For over 2,500 years, Jews were driven out of their homes in country after country after country. But despite the persecutions and even the unimaginable destruction of the Holocaust, sustained by the unswerving faith and trust in God and His Torah, throughout those 2,500 years, something remarkable happened. The Jews not only survived, but flourished and changed the world. Quote, Paul Johnson, author, A History of the Jews and a History of Christianity.
It is almost beyond our capacity to imagine how the world would have fared if they, the Jews, had never emerged. Certainly the world without the Jews would have been a radically different place. Humanity might have eventually stumbled upon all the Jewish insights, but we cannot be sure. To them we owe the idea of equality before the law, sanctity of life, dignity of the human person, social responsibility, peace as an idea, and many other items which constitute the basic furniture of the human mind. Without it, the world might have been a much emptier place.
Quote, John Adams, the second president of the United States.
The Hebrews, the Jews, have contributed more to civilized man than any other nation. They have given religion to 3/4 of the globe and have influenced the affairs of mankind more and more happily than any other nation, ancient or modern.
Quote, Woodrow Wilson, the 28th President of the United States.
The laws of Moses contributed suggestions and impulses to the men and institutions which were to prepare the modern world, and if we could have but the eyes to see, we should readily discover how much, besides religion, we owe to the Jews.
One remarkable fact is that since Alfred Nobel first created his prize, over 1/5 of all the Nobel Prizes have been awarded to Jews. Jews who comprise only less than 0.5% of the world's population, and yet have received over 20% of the Nobel Prizes for the greatest scientific, social, economic, creative, and intellectual contributions to the progress of mankind. But it is not only in their pursuit of human excellence that Jews have contributed more to the world relative to their numbers than any other people throughout history. It's their passion for meaning, purpose, morality in life, and their respect for human dignity that Jews have always been, for good and for bad, at the forefront of change. Quote, Winston Churchill, British Prime Minister.
Some people like the Jews, and some do not. But no thoughtful man can deny the fact that they are, beyond any question, the most formidable race that has ever appeared in the world.
But over and above their contributions to mankind, something else, something quite astonishing, occurred throughout Jewish exile. Over 2,500 years ago, there were approximately 10 million Jews in the world. Today, there are just under 14 million. In comparison, 2,000 years ago, there were approximately 30 million Chinese in the world. Today, there are over 1.4 billion. Throughout history, as if ordained, the Jews have remained small in number.
And only a small number will remain among the nations where God shall lead you.
And throughout these 2,500 years of exile, something equally astonishing happened. The Jews never let their dream of returning to their God-given ancient homeland. They never lost hope. They never stopped believing that one day their dispersion would end. In 1978, before a Soviet court about to sentence him to 15 years in prison for the so-called crimes of studying Hebrew, practicing Judaism, and requesting a visa for Israel, Natan Sharansky said,
"For 2,000 years, the Jewish people, my people, have been dispersed all over the world, and still, each year, Jews have stubbornly and apparently without reason said to each other, 'Lashana haba Yerushalayim,' next year in Jerusalem. And today, when I am further than ever from my dream and from my people, and when many difficult years of prison camps lie ahead of me, I say to my wife and my people, 'Lashana haba Yerushalayim,' next year in Jerusalem."
After 9 years of imprisonment, Natan Sharansky was freed, and in 1986, he immigrated to Israel. And the communist regime that suppressed and incarcerated him collapsed and no longer exists. In a similar ironic twist of history, after the Nazis were defeated in 1945, in 1948, only 3 years later, the United Nations voted for the re-establishment of the Jewish homeland, the State of Israel. To date, after 2,500 years of dispersion to over 100 countries on 5 continents, the Jews are the only people throughout history to survive, retain their identity, and return not only once, but twice from exile to their ancient homeland. The story of Abraham and the story of the Jews is the story of one man who dared to be different. And his descendants, a people whose wandering was endless, whose persecution was unremitting, whose vision for a better world was unparalleled, whose belief in one God and their commitment to his Torah and the dream of returning to their homeland were unshakable. One man, and from him, one people who dared to be different. Quote Thomas Cahill, The Gifts of the Jews.
Without the Jews, we would see the world through different eyes, hear with different ears, even feel with different feelings, and we would set a different course for our lives.
Quote J.M. Roberts, history of the world.
No other people has produced a greater historical impact from such comparatively insignificant origins and resources.
To understand the Jews, one has to understand history and the remarkable role they have played in it. However, to understand how they have survived, despite all odds, one has to look past history, into the world beyond the natural, into the realm of the divine. Here is what Sir Thomas Newton, Bishop of Bristol, said about the Jews in the 18th century.
The preservation of the Jews is really one of the most single and illustrious acts of divine providence. What but a supernatural power could have preserved them in such a manner, as no other nation has been preserved? And no less remarkable is the destruction of their enemies. Let it serve as a warning to all those who, at any time or occasion, are raising a clamor or persecution against them.
I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless those who bless you, and curse those who curse you.
If history and the story of the Jews has proven anything, it is that God has kept his covenant, his promise to the Jewish people. Here is a quote by Leon Tolstoy, the Russian writer, written in 1908.
What is the Jew? What kind of unique creature is this, whom all the rulers of all the nations of the world have disgraced, crushed, expelled, destroyed, persecuted, burned and drowned, and who, despite the anger and fury of their oppressors, continues to live and to flourish? The Jew is the symbol of eternity. He is the one who, following the faithfulness of his ancestors, has for so long had guarded the prophetic message and transmitted it to all mankind. A people such as this can never disappear.
Writing about the Jews in 1899, Mark Twain observed that
the Egyptian, the Babylonian, and the Persian rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to drink stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other people have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out, and they sit in twilight now or have vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality?